And you may have heard them say about you that you have your own subculture that draws you into faith, that you are led to believe because of your parents' belief or because of the community you were raised in. Or you may have heard that you have your own dysfunction, and so Christianity is a crux for you. You are walking around on crutches because you're a believer. Or you may have heard that sometimes you just got to take a leap of faith. You just got to take a leap of faith into the unknown. You may have heard that before. So what is the Christian response to these sorts of sayings? Well, let's first take the idea of irrational belief. And you know, like we've talked about before, that it's true that many people have walls and barriers that prevent them from becoming Christians because they have issues of unbelief related to the irrationality or the alleged irrationality of Christianity. Did I say irrationality? Okay, good. So these walls prevent people. They're real walls. We talked last week about emotional walls with the problem of evil and intellectual walls with the problem of evil. Well, these are really just philosophical or scientific-based intellectual walls. And they are really there. And usually this just comes out that you got to have an irrational faith if you want to be a Christian. So this subjective faith, as people have come to know Christianity as, is based on, according to them, a blind subjective faith, a blind faith, which is equivalent to claiming that we ignore all kinds of evidence to the contrary and we believe anyway. We believe because we want to believe, we believe because we need to believe, we believe because we have our own psychological dysfunctions, and this helps make sense of our life despite the fact that we were abused as children, neglected as children, and God is the real father figure we always wanted, you know, something like that. And so we ignore everything that points to the contrary. We ignore macroevolution, we ignore Big Bang cosmology, we ignore all of these things that would give us unbelief, that would help us to be rational with our thinking. And so they say that we take this leap of faith. And this leap of faith idea comes from a Danish philosopher, Soren Kierkegaard, from about 150 years ago. And he talked about this kind of faith that we refer to as blind faith now. Blind faith is really more like a wish. And non-Christians and Christians alike both refer to the Christian faith as a blind faith. And it's similar to like wishing for the tooth fairy to come to bring you a dollar for your tooth. There's really no evidence for the existence of the tooth fairy. You just believe anyway because you're just a child and you don't really have a good head on your shoulders. You don't really know the difference between fairy tale and reality. But fortunately, we do have something much more than a blind faith. We have knowledge. We have knowledge. And like we've talked about before in this class, knowledge is something that is very arrogant for the non-Christian to hear. And when we claim we have knowledge, they think we are being very arrogant because that automatically excludes the truth of other faiths, or the significance of other faiths, and all these cultures that are based on other faiths. And so when we say we have knowledge, we are making a big statement. Can we back that up? So going back to biblical faith, when you talk about faith, we want to be sure, and you want to be sure that you use faith in the right way. Use that word well. Don't misuse it. Blind faith is not biblical faith. Biblical faith is more along the lines of seeing faith. It's something that we do with our eyes wide open because we can see the actual world. We are not blind. We want to look at all the evidence that points to the contrary and not believe in spite of that, but believe because there's more evidence for the Christian belief system than there is for the non-Christian belief system. So seeing faith is a trust or commitment in something we know to be true. It's understanding based on evidence, awareness, and sound reason. This is seeing faith. This is what Hebrews 11 is talking about. So the non-Christian and the Christian both ought to realize that what we have is a belief that is justified and true. And a belief that is justified and true is knowledge. Remember we talked about JTB, justified true belief. That equals knowledge. This is a classical formulation and philosophy of what knowledge is. We need to be able to understand what knowledge is in order to say that we have it. So when you make the claim, I know God exists, you are saying that I have a belief that is true because it corresponds with the world. Remember, we talked about the correspondence theory of truth. And our belief is justified. What justifies the claim that God exists? Well, reason, awareness, and evidence. And the Christian has the luxury of having all three. We have awareness of God's existence through our direct perception of Him as He moves in us physically, heals us, speaks to us, gives us visions, these sorts of types of awareness. We have evidence of His existence historically with mankind, what sorts of things we are, His description of human history revealed to us in Scripture. Through the Jesus Christ and the cross and the resurrection and all the evidence for that and the archaeology that speaks to, again, more reliability of the Scripture. Scientifically, we have evidence for God's existence. We talked a lot about that in the last course. We'll touch on that a little bit tonight. Sorry? I'm a Dodger fan. I don't know. I don't do the Giants thing. Sorry. But a giant leap of faith. That's when Indiana Jones walked out into that cavern and he stepped on that invisible little walkway, the Last Crusade, Indiana Jones. That is blind faith. Yes. Right. So yeah, Indiana Jones took a giant leap of faith. You could put it that way. So the Christian response to this is that we are learning rational ways to understand the Christian worldview, God, and Christian theology. And we do that because it helps us bring down our walls of unbelief and it helps others bring down their walls. So we can know that belief is rational. We can have justified true belief. And so we can say that we have knowledge about objective reality, which is not based on our subjectivity. It's not based on our subjective perceptions about reality. So the Christian faith is based on knowing God personally, which requires that He exists. It's not wishful thinking. When we pray, we do not pray to something we don't believe is there. We really know that He is hearing us. We don't wish that He hears us. We don't think that He hears us. We don't believe that He hears us. We know He hears us. So this is a powerful claim. So we better have good evidence, we better have good awareness, and we better have good reasons. And we're going to talk about the reasons tonight, the reasons for God's existence. So arguments for the existence of God are not effective shouting matches that have been observed throughout the past to be effective in yelling people to salvation. We do not use these, and we have not observed these to be effective because they were yelled or shouted. So just because the word argument is used here, it does not mean that you need to go out on the street and use these in a shouting manner. Yeah. I mean, if someone's shouting back at you, I don't think it would be a good idea to shout back at him with this. So you got to just be careful for each person that you come across. But I definitely don't recommend shouting these ever at all. Because these are not shouting arguments. These are intellectual arguments. So these are usually done by two guys, if they're debating with each other in their 60s, you know, philosopher types, and they're sitting down on couches, you know, and you're just having a casual conversation. That's the context of this sort of thing. Yes, sir. Yeah, I think
for that,
well, here's my response. I gotcha. The thing is that we don't have complete knowledge of God because we say that we know Him. We have knowledge of Him, which does not have to be exhaustive. And that's why we went into Descartes' rationalism and skepticism at the beginning of the class. Because he thought that in order to have knowledge, you have to have 100% certainty. So when we say that we have knowledge, we are not claiming certainty. I think that will come out more as we go through this. Another thing, just to continue here, that we want to remember is that these are not deductive proofs, although they try to be. So in other words, when you're a philosopher, you can formulate an argument in such a way that the conclusion is necessary and 100% certain. Okay? These attempt to do that, although there is room and cushion there for play. In other words, someone could come up with a counter argument and attempt to refute our argument. Do they succeed? Well, that's the whole thing with philosophical apologetics. And the more you get into this, the more you realize that a lot of people have thought about each position in extreme depth. We're not going to be able to get into extreme depth tonight. But I do want to take this moment, actually, now that we're here, to introduce a couple resources to you. I have two of my favorite, again, and I've studied under these guys personally and have taken classes. William Lane Craig, you may have heard his name. This is one of his best works, Reasonable Faith. He wrote it about 30 years ago. It's been revised several times. And so this one just recently came out again a couple years ago, so it's kind of current in that sense. But if you are at all interested in getting more material, these two will be standards, should be standards in your library. A lot of what we've talked about and will talk about are based on these books. This is J.P. Moreland, Scaling the Secular City. And both of these guys are the best. Them, Ravi Zacharias, Oz Guinness, a few others, are the maybe top five, top four in that list in the world in terms of defending the faith. So I'll pass these around, and I encourage you not to put that in your purse or backpack. Let it just go to the back table. And then I wanted to introduce another book. This is called On Guard. Now, Reasonable Faith by William Lane Craig is it's not academic, but it's kind of between the popular level and academic in terms of resource. Now, this is very much geared for the popular level. It's called On Guard, and what it is, it's kind of like Reasonable Faith, but it's a little bit more accessible, user-friendly. He's got a bunch of diagrams in there, and believe it or not, there's a study guide here that goes along with it, and it could be a great resource for your church Bible study or class, whatever. And then here's a DVD companion. It's got William Lane Craig being interviewed in several different on several different topics, kind of like this, by this guy, and it was really well produced. They did a great job, and I highly recommend it. So I'll pass this around just for you to check it out. And you could order all this stuff, of course, on Amazon. But I just want to expose you to as much as possible to the most amount of resources that you can be exposed to. And for these sorts of things, you want to have these resources to help you out and dive deeper, because we're only going to be scratching the surface tonight. All right. So and arguments are tools that have been formulated over time to arrive at the conclusion that God exists. So these are tools. We don't want to forget about these. We don't want to misuse these. We don't want to abuse these. We want to pull out the tool at the appropriate time. So again, when somebody is crying because their child just died or their mother just died, don't bring up one of these arguments. Just not appropriate. So use them wisely. I mean, if you walk up to somebody in Starbucks or something, just don't start telling them, you know, going through reciting the argument. It just doesn't work. So be smart about this. And they will be effective. And fourth, these arguments reflect man's perpetual need to seek a being out there that exists. So we all have this existential drive in us to seek out something beyond ourselves, something beyond this earth, to know if really there are any quality alternatives to materialism and atheism. We all have this inert drive and tendency to kind of look above and beyond our mere existence in the here and now and look for the transcendent. Did anybody see the movie Transcendence this weekend, or last weekend? Good movie. Check it out. There's a lot of themes that we've talked about in this class in there. All right. So now, the top arguments for the existence of God are here on your page 3. The worldview argument is basically something we've been covering from week 1 to week 13. We went through the worldview argument. What was the worldview argument? It was that all these worldviews fail, and the Christian worldview is successful, and therefore the Christian worldview is the appropriate one to adopt. Why is it successful? Well, we're going to see, and with these three courses that I've provided and these arguments, we see that the evidence, awareness, and reasonableness of the Christian worldview stands up to scrutiny, whereas all of the other worldviews do not. So that's essentially the worldview argument. Choose the worldview that is the correct worldview. That's the worldview argument. And then that begs the question, well, what is the correct worldview? Now, the cosmological and teleological argument are the ones we're going to talk about tonight. So I won't talk about that right now. But the ontological, the axiological, which is also known as the moral argument, the argument from desire, the mind argument, the aesthetic argument, or the argument from beauty, and the religious experience argument are all really good arguments. Next week, we're going to have someone who's getting their PhD from Liberty University in apologetics, and it's a female apologist. Her name is Sarah, and she is the president of the International Society for Women in Apologetics, and she is going to be talking to us about the argument from desire next week. So be looking forward to that. And then the last thing I'll say is that of all these arguments, the best presentation, if you will, if you only had 5 minutes with someone, is to go for the resurrection. Go into the evidence for the resurrection. Go into the historical reliability of the Gospels and the New Testament documents and all the other documents, and discuss all the evidences for the resurrection. Now, if you had more time, you can usher in these arguments. But that is really our best tool, if you will, to use in a discussion with someone, to really go through the resurrection and lead them straight to Jesus, because the resurrection is that powerful of an apologetic. So let's look at our first argument tonight for the existence of God. We're going to start with the teleological argument. The teleological argument. These are the main proponents of the teleological argument: William Paley, Robin Collins, William Dembski, Philip Johnson, and William Lane Craig. Now, Paley lived a while back, but these other guys are doing an incredible job, not only in academia, but at the popular level, to advance these arguments. So I gave you some references there for you to check those out. If you want to go dive deeper into the teleological argument, just look at the bottom of your page in the footnotes, and you can buy those books on Amazon. Now, for background on the teleological argument, where does teleology come from? Well, it comes from the Latin telos, or telos, end or purpose. It has to do with end or purpose. So what is the purpose of something? What is the goal of something? What is the end of something? So teleology has to do with the designed goal or purpose in creation. That's kind of what that word is about. The designed goal or purpose in creation. So what are the basics of the teleological argument? Well, the argument is about how events, objects, and persons are alleged to reveal properties that suggest a purpose for their being. So when we look at certain objects and certain persons and certain events, we can see that there is a purpose to those things. And so then what do? We say that this purpose reveals design, which implies a designer. So when we encounter purpose, we realize that there's design, because otherwise, how could there be purpose? And this implies a designer who created them to fulfill their functions. So this is important. These things have functions. We have functions. So a watch was designed to express time. A fan was designed to blow air. Now you could use these things, we'll call them human artifacts, and you could do anything you want with them. You could take the blade out of the fan and use it kind of like a ninja star, attack your little brother or something like that. I'm a child at heart, sorry. I like to pick on my little brother. You could use a watch, you could take it apart, take the battery out and use it for something else. You could do other things with these things, but there is one purpose for that thing. There's one intention for that artifact. It was designed for typically one thing. It could have multiple applications. Now, when we think about the world, we can see in the world there are several things about the world that are not human artifacts that we just see occurring naturally, and we can also realize in them there is purpose. There seems to be design. So there's apparent design in the universe that we encounter. And the atheists and the non-Christians agree to this point. They don't disagree. They say, yes, there is apparent design. Things appear to be designed. They agree with that. So the eye appears to be designed for sight. It has certain components that lend the belief that it's designed for sight. The soul, we have a soul, we call it a soul. Non-Christians call it a mind, but they really think it's just the brain. The soul is designed with certain faculties. The mind was designed for thinking. The will is designed for acting and deciding. The imagination is designed for picturing things. So the soul, made up of all these different faculties, have different functions. Each faculty has a different function. And we know about the soul. The Bible speaks about it in Psalm 139. And I'd encourage you to check that out. It's a very therapeutic passage, if you want to think of it that way, because it talks to us about who we are and how God wonderfully fashioned us. And it's a brilliant passage, and hopefully it could be used to bring healing for your soul and other souls as you read through it. Now, let's continue talking about design here for a moment. There are different types of design in the universe. There are different types of design that we encounter as we walk around. We see design as order. We see design as purpose. We see design as simplicity. There's a minimalistic movement in architecture. You know, you sometimes see on the internet or something, you look at a house, it's in a forest, and there's like a desk and a chair and a bed and nothing else. You know, this minimalistic approach. This is designing for simplicity, and there's some beauty to that, right? Apple is kind of known for just having one button, and it's boring, you know. I'm just kidding. I'm an Android fan. But you get the idea. Simplicity is kind of a design objective. Complexity, you know, is the alternative. You know, you have these extremely complicated computers, and they have to be that complicated. They're designed that way. Design is information, like we talked about with the cell. There's information in the cell. You can read it. It can be transcribed into text. And design is beauty. So these are other ways that design is realized. Now, these arguments for design or purpose date back to the ancient Greeks. So these aren't new things that we've invented in the last 10 years because of the new atheists that have come out and dissed on Christians. So these guys, Cicero, Socrates, Plato, I can't pronounce that one, Galen, Xenophon, okay. And Aristotle contends that if the end or final causes cannot be found, then science itself is limited. So when we do science and we investigate reality, it's best to also investigate why something is the way it is, and what reason does this thing behave this way. So this is something that science ought to be investigating. So design is something that we actually pursue as a way of understanding the world we live in. We seek out design when we do science and when we do other things. So design is part of science. Now, two versions of the teleological argument are used for apologetics, and these are the ones that we want to focus in on tonight. We have the argument from analogy and the argument from inference. The argument from analogy and the argument from inference. So these are the two types of the teleological arguments out there. All right, so any questions so far? Oh, yeah? Well, okay, yeah, it depends on what... I would look it up in the original Greek. Yeah, there's some really cool words for the soul in Greek. I think it's soma. So maybe do a study on the word soma. Let's go ahead at this point and take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to dive deep into this, and then we're going to hit on the cosmological argument at the end there. Okay? That'll be a shorter part. So let's take a five-minute break. There are snacks in the back, and we'll be right back. All right, so let's go ahead and get started. We open the windows if you get hot. Apparently, the doors, sorry. Apparently, we've got some Starbucks coffee available back there, so that's pretty awesome. Yeah, so I'll be firing off some emails tonight really late. The last thing I wanted to plug and reveal to you, believe it or not, this is like the most shocking thing that I've ever encountered in apologetics. So I mentioned to you Dr. William Lane Craig, amazing apologist, amazing thinker. He has multiple specialties and is considered widely to be regarded as... one of the best philosophers in the world, him and J.P. Moreland, Alvin Plantinga, a few others that we have on our team. Believe it or not, he's concerned about the next generation, even our children. So he has teamed up with another person to help write books about children's books about what is God like. And it's not only theology, but there's some philosophy in there. And it's easy to get in, encounter some heresies when you're a child, and you don't want your children stoned or burned at the stake. So I encourage you to buy these for your children and grandchildren, and so they can grow up understanding God correctly from the get-go. And no, yeah, he doesn't even use. You can pass it around. He doesn't even use the word omnipotent or anything like that. Yeah. So you could read them to your grandchildren, to your children, buy them for your sons and daughters to read to their children. If you're a child, go ahead and read it, whatever. Better. So check that out. All right. So are you guys ready for the nuts and bolts here? We've introduced it, I think, pretty well. Well, are you ready to get into the details? Was that work for you? All right. Okay, so the classical teleological argument. This is the argument from analogy. You may have heard it before. Originally, it was put together by a guy named William Paley, who was a pastor in England at the time. In his book, Natural Theology, he formulated what we think of as the intelligent design argument, but he didn't call it that. And he kind of used a watch to develop his argument. So people consider it to be the watchmaker analogy. So when one is walking along a beach, he can encounter something in the sand. And he can reach down and look at it and pull it out and check it out and see, what is this thing in the sand? And lo and behold, someone may pull out a watch. And someone could then say, if he had never seen such a thing, what is this thing? It looks very intricate, it looks very complex, it looks very involved. What sort of a thing is this? What is the nature of this thing? And he could infer from this artifact that it had been designed because of its complexity, because of its properties. Those properties point towards design. So intuitively, he infers design. So living organisms, like human creatures, like dogs, fish, whatever, they are complex, like watches. Watches are designed by intelligent agents for a purpose. They're designed with thought. People had to think through some things before they started to build it. So living organisms seem to be designed by an intelligent agent who thought through some things and designed it all for a purpose. So because living organisms resemble human artifacts that we know are designed, one can infer by analogy that the human is designed, or the dog is designed. So due to the similarities, there is a good reason to infer design, because these things are similar. If they were not similar, we could not infer design. Okay, so keep that in mind. So another version may be worked out like this. Say U equals universe and A equals human artifact. So U has properties XYZ, and A has properties XYZ and I, let's just say. And you could replace U and A for anything. Therefore, it is reasonable to hold that U also has I. Because U and A have a lot of properties in common, because there are a lot of similarities, again the word similarities, between these properties of these two things, it's reasonable to infer that the second thing also has another property that the first thing has. The universe resembles human artifacts, as both seem to have order and a purpose. Since human artifacts are designed, it is reasonable to conclude that the universe is also designed. Okay, so these are kind of the two formulations of the argument from analogy. Okay, now these may stand out to you as pretty cool. It makes sense. You like it? And you're saying, I could use this. Okay. So here's the thing. these arguments focus on the similarity between the human artifact that we did design and the naturally occurring entity, whether it's the universe as a whole, whether it's a human creature, whether it's a dog. If these things are not similar, we don't have an argument. So the question is, are the universe and organisms actually similar to a designed human artifact with respect to order, complexity, purpose, etc.? That's the question. Do we have similarities? And critics argue that they are not similar, that human beings and human and other organisms and the universe is not similar to something that we design as humans. And supporters of the teleological argument contend that they are similar. They say we human beings, dogs, and other organisms in the universe, we are similar to things we know to be designed. So, there's two competing views. One says, yes, they are similar. One says, no, they're not similar. So now what does one do? Well, we could bring out all the reasons why these things are similar to make the argument from analogy hold. But we may need something a little bit more powerful, because the critic will press that these things just have the appearance of design. They aren't actually designed. So even if you say, look at all these ways the human creatures, as complex as we are, that dogs and plants and all these things, look at how complex they are. Can't you just see that it's designed? The response from the non-Christian will always be, it just has the appearance of design. And that's the fascinating thing about macroevolution. It brings with it the appearance of design because, in effect, that's what natural processes do. They funnel down to an evolved creature that has the best adaptive skills and things like that. So we need to be able to continue the conversation and not get stuck there. So what do we have to do? Well, we have to bring in a second type of argument. And this is the argument from inference. The argument from inference. And this has to do with the inference to the best explanation. The inference to the best explanation. So based on the highest probability and other reasons, we can make an inference to the best explanation of why a thing is the way it is. So William Dembski is a mathematician and philosopher based out of Baylor University in Texas. And he's written a lot of books in the last 15 years on intelligent design. And he is one of the major players in that movement. And he's put together a probability-based inference argument. And we'll talk about that in a moment, but we'll kind of get into some background first. So what are we talking about when we're talking about an inference? Well, reasoning from inference is done all the time. And even Charles Darwin employed this type of reasoning in his theory of natural selection. He asked, how can I best explain all of these observations I'm making? He inferred that the best explanation was natural selection based on random variations from common descent. So because of his observation, he was able to conclude through an inference that what best explains those things is macroevolution. So inference to the best explanation is used all the time, not only in science, but in academia, in philosophy, and all other things, and we use it in our own practical living. So this is not a new concept to you. You make inferences every day. A mechanic makes an inference when he is diagnosing a car. He's looking at all these things. Sensor gauges are telling him this and that. He's seeing something hang off the car broken. You know, all of these things will help him build a case, so to speak, towards the correct diagnosis of the vehicle's problems. Judges in a courtroom make inference all the time. When given a certain amount of evidence, they make decisions, and juries do this too. Based on the mountain of evidence that's put together, They infer guilt or innocence. They don't know based on 100% certainty, but they have various levels that they need to meet in terms of their certainty meter to make a decision. And Bible interpreters do this all of the time too. We make inferences to the best explanation of the passage or the best the meaning of the passage. We don't know with 100% certainty what a passage means, but we can know pretty much with sometimes with 99% certainty or 50% certainty, we can know a lot of things. Like, for instance, the passage in in John, I think, when Jesus resurrected all of the, or I can't remember where exactly, but around the crucifixion resurrection passage, when all of the saints appeared, all the dead saints appeared in Jerusalem and were walking around, this very odd passage, and nobody knows what it means. N.T. Wright even doesn't know what it means, and he's written a 700, 800 page book on the resurrection, scholarly book. And people have been thinking through this for the past 2,000 years. N.T. Wright himself said in an academic conference recently, if you know the meaning of the passage, let me know, because I don't know. I mean, if he doesn't know, no one knows. And all these commentators throughout the centuries have been trying to figure out what this passage means. So all we can do is our best to mine out the author's original meaning. We've got to do our best. We got to do our homework. And we could be wrong. We may not be right. But we can know, for the most part, pretty well, most of the Bible with a high degree of certainty. So the point is that we infer from all this data that we have, the historical situation, what we know about the author from other passages, what the meaning of a passage is. So we build up a case. We put all this evidence together and infer the conclusion. So this inference to the best explanation is known as abductive reasoning or abduction in philosophy. So this is a type of inference that assigns special status, like truth or best, to explanatory considerations. So what that means is, given evidence E and candidate explanations H1 through HN of E, infer the truth of HI, which best explains E. Did you catch that? Yeah, that's fun. So given all of these hypotheses, H1 through H, say, 5, say you have 5 hypotheses that you put together to explain all of this data, whether it's a Bible passage or the guilt of innocence of somebody. Hypothesis 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 are on the table because they seem to be the best out of, say, 20. And then what do you do from here? You have to funnel it down to one and pick one. Well, how do you do that? And that's the idea, is that you pick one here, and when you've done so, we'll talk about how to do that in a second, but when you've actually chosen the hypothesis, what you've done is you've said, this hypothesis is the best explanation given the data. So you infer the conclusion given all the data, and that's called abductive reasoning, and you do it all the time. All right, now, this argument does not depend on us trying to explain the explanation. So when you arrive at hypothesis 3, and you say, that's it, that's the best explanation, we know this for a variety of reasons, you don't have to explain the hypothesis. You can just land there and stop, and you would have accomplished the goal of your argument. So with the design argument, we have to do is say that based on all of these things, based on all this evidence, and based on all these competing explanations, this one is the best, and this one says that the universe or the organism is designed. And then you stop. Because design implies a designer, and then the question is, well, what sort of a thing is that designer? And that's a whole different set of things altogether. So we need to go step by step here, And that's the goal of the design, the teleological arguments, is to arrive at the conclusion that this thing is designed. So more on that in a second. Now, the best explanation of appearance of design, we have all these competing explanations. So how do we choose the best one? It appears that the most plausible explanation of the evidence is that the organism or universe is designed. That's what our goal is with all this. It appears that the best explanation is that it all is designed. And we can infer this logically and rationally, and thus it's a reasonable inference. So that's the idea. So when compared to the other theories that attempt to explain the data, the design inference is preferred as it satisfies the criteria for making good inferences to the best explanation. These next things right here are ways to understand how to get to the best explanation with a bunch of competing explanations. So you can read through that, and you could set these criteria up against all these competing hypotheses, and with that set of criteria, you can arrive at the conclusion of which one's the best. So that's the criteria that you apply. So moreover, other theories may also be rejected on their own accord. So for instance, let's say hypothesis 4 is self-refuting, like some of the worldviews that we've encountered, like say naturalism. Let's say hypothesis 4 was naturalism. Because it's self-refuting, it rules itself out. Let's say the best explanation for the appearance of the design in the universe is H1 is, aliens are out there and they designed it all. Well, that's not self-refuting, so it can stay up there. You see what I'm saying? So that's the idea, is that some things just self-refute and they can't be considered in the conversation for best. All right, so a little background here on William Dembski, with this argument. He provides a philosophical argument with premises and conclusion. Its soundness is based on the truth or falsity of the premises, which depend on probabilities based in scientific observations and mathematical modeling. So what Dembski does, because he's a mathematician and a philosopher, is he kind of puts all this together, and that's why we have such a compelling argument, because he's done such a great job. Because all those criteria right above there, they're powerful, but what Dembski does is he gives us something even more powerful. He gives us what he calls the explanatory filter and something called specified complexity, and that's based on probabilities, and we'll get into that in a second. But just to give you some background again on the philosophical argument that's based on probabilities. Dembski holds that this argument is only valid if probabilities are such that the design option is detected, so one can detect design in the universe, and physical necessity and chance are improbable. That's the idea. So if you have physical necessity and chance, and one shows them to be improbable, and design is detected, then you have strong, compelling, powerful evidence that design is the best explanation. So one can rule out physical necessity and chance with probabilities, with mathematics, with statistics. So we have, let's say, physical necessity when we're trying to explain the design and order in the universe. The first option is physical necessity. So we're going to talk about this in a second. H3 we'll call design because that's circled here. And let's call this chance because that's going in order. I'll just redo it here. So this is chance. And then H5 we'll call that design. Okay, so this is kind of Dembski's explanatory filter. And the idea with this is a little complicated, but we'll get through it real quick, I guarantee. So the last point here is that if chance and physical necessity are improbable, and design is detected, then we can conclude that design is the best explanation. Now, a little overview of the argument. The apparent design we encounter in the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. So this is the argument, okay? Physical necessity, chance, or design. The design in the universe is, or the apparent design is due to these three, one of these three things. It is not, this is the second premise in the argument, it is not due to physical necessity or chance. That's the second premise. So you look at physical necessity by itself. You ask the question, could it be from physical necessity? Could the universe, due to laws of nature, due to inherent properties in the chemicals, in the cosmos and on the earth, is it the case that based on the inherent properties and the laws of nature that the universe would have produced itself or that it would have produced humankind? And the answer is no, but we don't have time to get into that. Sorry. We did spend a whole course on this, so like 3 or 4 months of this last year. The second question you ask, well, is it due to chance? Is it possible that the universe could have arisen by chance and that human creatures could have arisen by chance? And the answer is no. Now, I'm not giving you any supporting backing for this and evidence for this, but you have to listen to the files online or take the next class. Therefore, it is due to design. That's the final thought here, the final conclusion. And so the best explanation we could say for the apparent design in the universe is design. So that's where we finish. This now becomes the best because of Dembski's explanatory filter. And we'll talk about that more in a moment. But that's kind of the gist of the abductive argument. You look at all these competing hypotheses and you choose which one explains it the best, given all that criteria that I mentioned above and probabilities. So what Dembski does is he uses all these probabilities and statistics to point to the truth that physical necessity and chance are completely improbable. They are so improbable. They are astronomically improbable. The probability of chance and physical necessity producing the universe and human creatures is extremely low. Let's put it that way. It's like 10 to the minus 120th power. It's mind-boggling. To try to hash that out, it's just unbelievably difficult even to comprehend. So that's the idea. It's based on scientific data. It's based on all this evidence from science. He puts it all together, and he does a statistical analysis on it, so to speak, and he arrives at the conclusion that these things are so improbable, they just can't happen. It's irrational, so he excludes these, and then he has this what he calls this specified complexity detection instrument, if you will, where he can go around the universe and detect specified complexity in the cell, and in the fine-tuning of the cosmos, and he can arrive at the conclusion that the universe and human creatures and organisms are designed. So that's what the next thing looks like. Specified complexity is the instrument, but it's a probability-based design inference argument. Now, these next 2 points, 7 and 8, is where I kind of unpack that a little bit. We can quickly unpack the first, and it'll make sense to you. So to apply the inference argument to the cosmos and the universe, let's do that. So it's pretty simple. It goes like this. Fine-tuning is what we're talking about. It's at the very beginning of time. We realize that the universe had in it fine-tuning, meaning that when the universe expanded and when God created it, he packed in it all of this fine-tuning. Now, the non-Christian's not going to say when God created it, but they are going to agree with you that it is fine-tuned, finely tuned. They acknowledge that and say, yes, we agree that there is a fine-tuning, but for them, they explain it a little differently, why that fine-tuning is there. So there's no disagreement that there is fine-tuning. Okay? So what options are available to explain this fine-tuning and observed features in the universe? Well, you have physical necessity, and you have chance, and you have a bunch of other options. Okay? Well, it can't be physical necessity. It can't be chance. So it could be a bunch of other options. with the cosmos, and in the last class, like I mentioned, we go through each one of these options and we look at why these options fail. You have the multiverse option. You may have heard that before. You have the changing parameters over time, that the fine-tuning in the cosmos is only the way it is right now because it's just the time when it is these cosmological constants are dialed into this certain setting. Given another billion years, the cosmological constants will slightly vary, and they will be dialed into a second setting, a different setting, and the universe won't be fit for life. So when we're talking about fine-tuning the universe, we're talking about the constants and the features of the universe and our solar system and our galaxy that allow life to be possible. So they say that these parameters, these cosmological constants, can change. They were different, say, a billion years before, and they will be different a billion years from now. And it just happens to be the case that they allow life on Earth. So that's an alternative naturalistic explanation for fine-tuning. It's just that we happen to catch it at the right time, and in fact, that's why we're here. And then they have the M theory, or theory of everything. There's the bounce hypothesis, that the universe just bounces, expands and contracts for infinity. So there was a Big Bang, yes, but there's eventually going to be a cold death, and it's all going to contract, and gravity is just going to pull it in again to get to infinite density, and then the heat will be so extreme that it'll Big Bang again. And it'll keep doing that, expanding and contracting forever. And we just happen to be in one of these expansions, and it's a random one, just like all the other ones, and it happened to be finely tuned, create a universe that allows life. And we happen to be situated in a planet such as this that allows life. So, of course, eventually humans are going to arise. Black hole created universe, same idea, is that the universe is sucked in by black holes and that it expands on the other side, and that other universe is created, and that's how we're created. And once you get tons and tons of black holes and a bunch of universes popping out of black holes, eventually you're going to get a universe like this that's finely tuned for life. The boundless finite universe is Stephen Hawking's view, steady state model. We get into detail with all of these things in the last class, which we'll do again. And then we rule those out and we say, no, those cannot possibly be the case because of all these reasons, because of all these other ideas that go against it, and all these other pieces of evidence that rule it out. And then you have design, and then you say from there that of all of the options available, again, hypothesis H through whatever, 10 in this case, the design option is the best because these things are either extremely improbable based on statistics and scientific evidence, and design is detected using the specified complexity filter or instrument, and then you have justification for your inference, that design is the appropriate conclusion. So therefore, the best explanation of the cause of the universe is design, thus a designer exists. So that's one way to do the teleological argument. Okay? Now, we do the same thing with biochemistry here, and it's kind of basic, but you kind of get the idea. You could read through that on your own time. And then you have, next, the cosmological argument. Now, given the fact that it's 9:45, we're going to just shoot through this. If you have questions, we can talk about it later. Now, you're going to have the counter-argument, which I'm not completely presenting here, but I am presenting you with at least the alternatives that are out there, physical necessity, chance, and then all these other options. So then it gets very complicated from here on out, and that's when you just got to open up a book and read it, because, or you got to come to the next class or something like that. You just can't go through all of the counter-arguments in 15 minutes. It's not possible. So we're going to go ahead and jump into the next one. It's the cosmological argument. Now, these are the two most popular arguments for the existence of God, just to let you know, in classical philosophy. Here are all of the people who have put forward this argument in history and recently. And it has two different versions. The cosmological argument has two different versions. There's the contingency version, and the Kalam version. The Kalam you're not going to like this, but it comes from a Muslim guy, Al-Ghazali. Christians have taken it and reappropriated it, put some better stuff together around it. But Al-Ghazali, about 1,000 years ago, put together this argument because Muslims are theists. Now, I don't want that to distract you from this argument because it's an awesome argument. And William Lane Craig uses it. It's called the Kalam Cosmological Argument. It's kind of towards the end here. So it's very, very popular, and it's very, very good. So we're going to finish with that one. But to go back to Leibniz's contingency cosmological argument, Leibniz was a French philosopher from a few hundred years ago. And he actually, him and Aquinas was an Italian theologian and philosopher from about, 900 years ago. They kind of put forward this contingency version. So when I talk about that we stand on the shoulders of giants, these guys are the giants. Aquinas, Samuel Clarke, and others. So the Christian faith has a rich heritage of intellectual power behind it to stand on. So you should be a happy camper knowing that we have many more smart guys on our side than they do on their side. Both in history and currently. Now, what does it mean to say something is contingent? What does that mean? What does that word mean? What does it refer to? Contingency, contingent. What's that?
Adjacent.
Dependent upon is a really good word. Something is the way it is because another thing caused it to be that way, but it could have been different. It didn't have to be that way. It could have been otherwise. So contingent is the antonym necessity. So when somebody says, I am a contingent being, they are saying, I am not necessary. So when we say God is a necessary being, we're saying he's not contingent. Meaning he could not have been any different. We could have been different, but God could not have been. So this idea of contingency starts with thinking about a series of events. So suppose you have the event that Dan is throwing a birthday party for John. And Dan is throwing this birthday party because he likes John. And then John decides, I'm going to throw a birthday party for Chris. Not that Chris, but that Chris. And then Chris decides to throw a birthday party for Linda. No, not that Chris. And you get the idea that this series of birthday parties could continue and continue and continue forever, as long as we're alive, I guess. But when you start thinking about activities that happen, and events that happen, things could be different. Like, Dan could have decided, even though he likes John, to throw a birthday party for Wilton, and then for some reason, Wilton throws a birthday party for Chris, that Chris. And so you get the idea. It could have been different. So when you start tracing a series of events back through time, you could arrive at something different. In fact, according to the multiverse explanation, the universe could have been different. We could be here, but slightly different than we are now, in a different way, different capacity, with different personalities. Given the infinite amount of possibilities that could have occurred, you could have a bunch of different things happening. Nothing is necessary for things that exist contingently. So one can question that, why is the universe the way it is this way? Why do we find it like we do? It could have been different. So then someone has to ask, well, what is the reason for its being this way? And this is what philosophers call the principle of sufficient reason. It's been around for forever. And that just says that there's a reason for the thing. There's a reason for the way things are the way they are. Things could have been different, but the way they are is because someone wanted them to be that way. You wanted to throw a birthday party for John. You changed your mind. You threw it for Wilton. You have a reason. It's a sufficient reason that caused you to do something different. And we take that principle of sufficient reason. We apply it to the universe. And we say, God created a universe this way. Of all the possible worlds he could have created, he created this one for some sufficient reason. Okay? And I'm kind of skipping through that a little bit. But this is basically the form of the argument right here. If you want to have present this argument from contingency, it goes something like this. Every existing thing has an explanation of its existence. We have an explanation for our existence. We have a sufficient reason. Either in the necessity of our own nature or in an external cause. Now, it could have been the case that because of macroevolution, we are the way we are. Or there could be an external cause causing us to be the way we are. There could be some external sufficient reason. If the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is God. So if the universe has an explanation, that explanation is God. We say that the universe is an existing thing, and everybody agrees to that, because we all know the universe exists. Therefore, the explanation of the existence of the universe is God, a necessary being. Now, it's a little tricky, but that's the basic thing. And the idea is that anything that exists has to be a contingent being. And when you trace the reason for that being's existence back, way back when, all you get is reason after reason after reason from other contingent beings that decided or caused that you or I to exist eventually. And you can't keep tracing back to infinity contingent events, because infinity past is not possible. And so you have to arrive at a necessary being that grounds all contingent beings forward. So you go back all the way through infinity past, and eventually you have to get to a necessary being. So here's us today. We got our Bible in our hand, and we're happy campers, and we were here because of a bunch of different events, and you trace that all the way back to infinity past, infinity, you know, mathematical expression, and all of these little dots are all these little contingent events. And they cause things to occur forward in time because of the principle of sufficient reason. But you can't go back to infinity because that's impossible. There can't be an infinite past. And we don't have reasons to go into why there can't be one. We don't have time. But eventually, if you do follow the contingent trail, you continue just to go back to an infinite past, which is absurd because there can't be one. Therefore, there has to be a necessary being that grounds all contingent future reality. Does that make sense? So eventually, you get to God, because God is the only necessary being. So you can say, if you're drawing this, hopefully you are, God is the necessary being. And he's got to be there to start time. Okay, so we don't have time to draw that out, but that's the basic idea. Now, you're going to have detractors to this argument, and they're going to give you counterarguments, but again, we just have time to scratch the surface here, and you could get your PhD in philosophy by diving into this one argument right here. Okay, so then the second way the cosmological argument is presented, and by the way, cosmological is just the big word there, is used to refer to the idea that we're trying to explain the foundation of the cosmos. We're trying to understand the origin of the cosmos, and that's why these two are called cosmological argument. So the first one has to do with taking back contingent events all the way back to a necessary being based on the principle of sufficient reason. And the second one has to do with cause and effect. Cause and effect. And again, Aquinas, 900 years ago, talked about this. Clark developed it further. Now William Lane Craig is the expert on this one and goes around the country and the world debating using the Kalam cosmological argument. and he wins every single time. Now, this little diagram hopefully is helpful. You have the universe at the top. The universe either has a beginning or it doesn't have a beginning. Beginning or no beginning. And then you can conclude that it has a beginning, and from there you can say the beginning was caused or not caused. And then from there you conclude that it was not caused, it was caused, and you can conclude that it was either personal or impersonal. And from there you can conclude that it was not impersonal, impersonal, so then you can conclude that it was personal, and that's how you get to God from the cause of the universe. So diagrammatically, that's kind of the story. Now let's look at the overview here. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. Okay, this is a principle I think many people, everybody in the world will agree with. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. A cause that causes it to exist. The universe began to exist. Again, we're talking about the cosmos and how to explain the cosmos. The universe began to exist, and currently science supports this idea. Science, by the way, did not start supporting this idea, even though the Bible long told of the origin of the universe. Science didn't start supporting this idea until about the 1940s and 50s. And a priest in France is the one who really developed this first, and Einstein and Hubble and others took it on later, talking about how the universe exploded and expanded from a singularity. So you have a Catholic priest and the Bible talking about the origin of the universe, where science held for a whole bunch of time, say a couple thousand years, that the universe was in a steady state. It was just eternal. It had no beginning, and there would be no end. So the beginning of the universe that the Bible taught was in contrast to science for thousands of years up until about 50, 60 years ago. So the universe began to exist. Everyone agrees on that. Therefore, the universe has a cause. So deductively here, we have a foolproof argument. There is no room, wiggle room. There is no inference to the best explanation here. You have the conclusion because of the way this argument is structured. It's formulated in such a way that it's foolproof, and one has 100% certainty of the third point here, that the universe has a cause. Now, then you go to abductive reasoning to get from 3 to 4. The best explanation of the cause of the universe is God. So you have to use now abductive reasoning and build a case for God after premise 3. So 1, 2, 3 are straight up philosophical premises from Aristotelian logic from 2,500 years ago from Aristotle, in terms of the flow and the function. But to get from 3 to 4, that's when you use abductive reasoning and inference like we talked about before. So let's look at, detailed overview. We don't have time. It's 9 o'clock. But here you have a detailed overview of these 4 points. And if you just kind of cruise through there, you could see a little bit more elaboration on that cosmological argument. Let's go over this argument just one more time right here. The first 4 things. Let's just read them together. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. The best explanation of the cause of the universe is God. So it's simple. It's nice. You can memorize it. You could use it on the street. It's foolproof up to premise 3. And then from premise 4, that's where you got to do the work. Now, philosophers will debate Craig and others who are advocates of this argument on premise 1 and 2. Craig has done extensive work on this. He does debates on this. He does Reasonable Faith Podcast. That's the name of his organization. And if you have iTunes or Android, whatever app, I use Beyond Pod for Android. You can get his stuff. Or he has an app. It's called Reasonable Faith for iTunes and Android. Reasonable Faith. He's got, check this out. He's got not only all these podcasts for like, I don't know, 5 years worth of podcasts he's done once a week, and where he talks about his debate. After the debate, he'll go and chat about it with the guy interviewing him. But he also has a class that he teaches at his local church, kind of like this. I'm sure there's probably couple hundred people in there. And he teaches it every Sunday. So if you happen to know somebody in Georgia, tell them about his church, because it's awesome. And so they've recorded all these classes throughout the last, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years, and they're all there on his Reasonable Faith app. So I'm sure you all have smartphones. You can download it tonight. And I guarantee you, if you want seminary-level quality education, if you want to learn from one of the brilliant minds of our time, check out that app and start listening to his Defenders class. It's right there on the app. It's called Defenders. And not only does he go through philosophical apologetics, which is what he's a philosopher, but he goes through systematic theology. He actually has another PhD in theology from some German school. So he speaks German fluently too. And he goes through, even he'll talk about old earth creationism and young earth creationism and evolution and all that stuff. So, I mean, the guy's just got a ton of knowledge, and I really encourage you to go check out Reasonable Faith, his website. There's scholarly articles that he's submitted to professional academic journals, and so forth. And he has an app, like I mentioned. Okay. So, I'm just going to let it go there and encourage you to continue checking this stuff out. I've given you exposure to all these resources. Like I said, we can get into all the counter arguments, but it would take a while. So I just want to encourage you to do your own study on this now. So if you have questions or comments, you want to chat with me after, or you want to chat with me about these the details of these things, I can get into it with you after the class. Good. Oh, good. Matthew 27:53 about the saints cruising around Jerusalem. Okay. All right. Let's pray. Would someone want to close us in prayer by any chance?